This is a Hat Trick podcast.
Oh, lovely.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Do you remember your sex education? Was it helpful to you? Was it filled with scientific information rather than real, practical advice? I'm Diggory Waite, and this is The Real Sex Education. Each week, I'll be joined by a guest. We'll impart our own sex wisdom, ask our own sex questions, and we'll go over all the things they don't teach you in school. To bring this all together, though, we'll need an expert. A sexpert, if you will. But the only sex and relationship therapist I know is my mum. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Diggs.
On the show today, we speak to comedian and quizzer Paul Sinha.
This is officially my entry into the United Kingdom podcast scene.
We speak about finding your perfect match.
There are 15 different people who want to discuss last week's FA Cup semi-final on my grinder.
The unbearable jealousy that Paul felt at public school.
I wasn't a boarder, but every time you start hearing rumours that sort of things are going on at boarding school, you would feel insanely jealous.
And we find time for Paul to tell us a joke as well.
What I call jokes that changed my life.
Welcome to The Real Sex Education. I'm Diggory Waite, and as ever, I'm joined by sex and relationship therapist Kate Campbell. Hello, Mum.
Hello, Diggs.
How are you doing today?
Great, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. I mean, we have a great interview with Paul Sinha coming up. Very open, yeah. Very honest.
One of the things about the interview is that Paul came with a story to tell, and that's a bit different from the usual way the show goes. I mean, his sex education, for instance, was very, very basic. And I know a lot of people in the 80s said, you know, they just got to watch a film or something like that. I guess it's a mercy that you weren't around in the 80s because you could never just sit and watch a film, could you?
I had to go and act it out. That would have been weird.
That would have been weird in the classroom.
That would have been really weird. I'd watch a film. Like, what was my first film?
The first time at the cinema was A Bug's Life. And you lay under the seats of people eating popcorn and with your mouth open.
So I didn't watch the film at all?
Not really.
But no, I'd watch a film at home or whatever, and then I'd be like, right, I've had enough of this now. I've seen enough on screen that now I'm just going to do it myself. So I then would get my toys out and I'd act out the rest of the film.
Yeah,
myself.
And do little drawings of all the characters and things like that. Yeah.
God, just... what changed?
Good point.
Well, before you listen to Paul Sinha's interview, I'd just like to remind you that at the end of our show, we give you the chance to have your questions answered by Kate, a real sex and relationship therapist. You can send in your queries to podcasts@hattrick.com. That's Hattrick with two T's. But before we get there, we spoke with Paul Sinha, the only openly gay, British Asian, qualified doctor and television quizzer on the United Kingdom podcast scene.
This is officially my entry into the United Kingdom podcast scene.
Yay.
Before I was just somebody who sometimes did podcasts, now I'm actually part of a scene, and it's very exciting.
I have to say, I did nick that line from one of your stand-up pieces where you said it was the United Kingdom comedy scene, so I hope you don't mind me...
Of course not. These are my words. You've only changed one word.
That's true enough. So let's get right down and dirty with it. It's called The Real Sex Education, this podcast. So what was your sex education actually like?
It's hard to start without giving some background to how odd it is to have the realisation that you're travelling in a different lane to everybody else.
Mm.
By which I mean I knew I was gay from about the age of eight.
Right.
From about the age of eight, I found myself emotionally and at some other level attracted to other boys in my school. And I just didn't know what was going on. And nobody told me. No, you know, there was no information about it. There was just a sense that Mr. Humphreys and Are You Being Served might be having similar tastes to you. I'm born in 1970, to give everyone a sort of time context. When you add to that, I'm from, I'd say, a traditional Bengali family, highly educated. My dad a doctor, my mum a nurse, my dad's dad a doctor. They would have come to Britain essentially to give their kids the best education. although not conservative with a big C, I say conservative was still what they were. Add that to that, and you get a situation where I'm not being having access to any real level of information at all as to what's happening with me. Then add to that that I went to a traditional all-boys prep school and a traditional all-boys public school. And you have a situation where not only am I confused and walking down a different lane, but I'm being constantly stimulated, constantly, by the fact that I'm surrounded by people that I'm attracted to. There is a massively strong tradition of teenage homosexual activity, particularly if you're boarding.
Yeah.
I wasn't a boarder, but every time you start hearing rumours of the sort of things that are going on at boarding school, and you would feel insanely jealous that you were a day student.
Yeah.
But like a lot of schools, and I mean, you must stress this in the 1980s, sex education, as in what the school provided when it comes to sex education, was simply a mechanism by which you would pass, in my case, O-level, but now GCSE biology.
Yeah.
While all the other kids were giggling and going, I was like, what? That goes in there? I'm not going to do that. Are you insane?
So if you look at the board now, we've taken a detailed look at both the female reproductive organ and the male reproductive organ. And in this next slide, everyone, we're going to see how they come together. Okay, here we go.
I don't believe it.
Glass, settle down, please. Settle. Oh, goodness. Lucy, could you get mentioned, please? I think Paul might have fainted. So we'd spoken to Paul about his sex education at school in the 1980s and how there was nothing in that sex ed schooling to do with homosexuality. That wasn't due to an oversight or incompetence on the teacher's part. It was actually due to a piece of legislation referred to as Section 28. That prevented teaching about homosexuality. Could you tell us a bit more about that legislation, Mum?
Well, Section 28 was Section 28 of the Local Government Act 1988, but that's also amended other acts in the rest of the UK, which meant that it was illegal to suggest that a gay family could be considered normal or to really talk about being gay at all. So sex education in schools became really basic because everyone was so scared. Everyone was terrified of mentioning anything about gay sex or anything remotely different in case it meant they ended up in trouble.
When was this? 1988?
That was 1988. The whole thing started earlier in the 80s when the Daily Mail ran a campaign suggesting that left-wing councils were hurting family values by containing books that were about gay families, I guess. So there was one called Jenny Lives with Eric and Martin. That was a book by Suzanne Bosch. And it was about a little girl who was brought up by gay dads. So we would take that kind of book for granted nowadays. But at the time, it caused a terrific stir. And it set forth this whole witch hunt almost, which meant that you just couldn't talk about gay sex at all in schools or for youth groups and that sort of thing. A lot of youth groups that were helping young people closed down. And it meant really that there was nowhere for people to go, nowhere for young people to go for advice. And Paul makes this very clear. He felt very out there on his own. There was no support, no help available. And teachers could be in really serious trouble for offering it, or youth workers could get into trouble. And it came in the kind of atmosphere of HIV/AIDS, which had just started in the 80s. And so there were, because that affected some gay men, there was a lot of feeling that there was something off about gay people. Not everybody thought that at all, absolutely. Mm. But that sort of feeling was fueled a bit by inaccurate newspaper stories and that sort of thing. So it was a really, really difficult time.
Mm. So there was because of the HIV/AIDS crisis in the 80s, which, like you say, led to this sort of hysteria around gay people in the gay community. And that's what fueled this Section 28 and a lot of this.
Right. The government was very keen on promoting the idea of the traditional nuclear family. And of course, you know, anything like this seemed to be detracting from that. So it was very difficult. And it was a long time. It was actually 2000, 2003 before it started changing in different parts of the UK.
So was this affecting primary schools or secondary schools or everything?
Everything. Yeah.
Wow.
You just couldn't talk about it.
It's interesting as well, because you hear about the book and this legislation and you think, okay, well, that was then. And now we've come so much further. But you hear about what's going on currently in the Midlands in Birmingham, and a concerted effort from people to stop similar things being taught about, you know, homosexuality, about trans people. There's still people today who don't want these things taught to children at school.
Well, that's some parents, and I think that's happened because there's so much noise in the media about and on social media about some of the things associated with sex education at the moment, that they've perhaps got the wrong idea about what it involves. And when you don't understand something or don't know about it or don't have a balanced view, it's very easy to take a particular polarised view and just say, oh no. And of course it's understandable because people are worried about their children and they're worried about the children's welfare, but it's possibly mistaken.
I wish there was a more interesting tale about how I dealt with this mystery. I may not have known if that's alive. All my friends did. And a guy called Bappy, whose family we stayed with a lot during Christmas, told me, we were staying in his room, me, Bappy and one of his friends, when he told the following joke, what I call the joke that changed my life. And the joke was, a woman walks into a sperm bank and says, I'd like to make a deposit. And then she spits into a handkerchief. That is the joke that changed my life. The reason being, Bappy's friend laughed uproariously at the joke, and Bappy uproariously laughed at the joke he just told. And I quite clearly didn't get the joke. I didn't understand what the joke meant at any level. And then Bappy went, ah, right. And he stood up, and he dragged up from the top level of his shelves a Star Wars toy box. And inside was hardcore pornography.
Wow.
And he went through, from start to finish, what men and women actually do. And I could never be more grateful to him for that evening in Rochdale, because suddenly I understood everything. I understood that I was gay. I understood that I would never be doing any of these things. I understood that heterosexual people don't just have sex to procreate. And my whole life, honestly, the whole way that I viewed life suddenly transformed, as I went from shy, bookish, travelling down a different lane, Paul Sinha, to, I understand everything now. Now I can be the person I want to be, funny, observational, and with an understanding of human nature. That whole evening changed everything. Those pornography magazines was my sex education. No use to my own personal development as a person with his own sexuality, but a lot of use to how I saw the world.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So with his poor sex education in mind and Section 28 still being prevalent at the time, I asked Paul what effect that had.
I was ill-prepared as a result for going out into the big wide world. It was quite obvious that I didn't really know what I was meant to be doing in bed. I was a medical student in London, I had access to a gay scene in London, and I just didn't know anything. I didn't know what it was I was meant to be doing. I didn't realise that you don't have to do whatever it is that you were meant to be. I don't think you don't actually, it's not a compulsion, it's entirely your choice. One of the things I found fascinating about how people perceive gay men is that they all think gay men do this and do that and do this. And I have to try and explain to them this notion that the anal sex is what we do is absolute nonsense.
It's just another heteronormative idea, isn't it?
And it took me a while to realise that.
Yeah.
It took me a while to realise, actually, just do what you feel comfortable with.
Precisely.
You don't have to do what heterosexuals think you do. And that was if you talk about sex education, I did it on the go.
But the point you make about not having to do what somebody else wants you to do is really important, because I think even today I talk to a lot of young people coming out and feeling that they're doing it wrong, and they're being told by somebody more experienced, well, if you were a real gay, you'd do this. And that still happens. So, that's an important point to get across.
I mean, my first... In some ways, I want to be open and say, no, I'm going to say it. My first encounter was abusive.
Oh.
There was a fair degree of what I would call non-consensual activity, and there was a fair degree of consensual activity, and there you have the situation where you don't know what you're meant to be doing, and suddenly the guy's resenting the fact that you're actually saying no to stuff, because he'd assumed, because you'd said yes to some stuff, that you'd say yes to all stuff. And that's kind of what I mean by education on the go, is I had to understand what it was I wanted to do and what it was I didn't want to do, and that it was okay to just say no.
Before we go any further, what is consent?
Well, it's complex, really. I mean, I suppose it's about giving permission without coercion to give that permission, and to maintain that permission as well.
So permission for sexual activity in
this
case.
Well, yeah, and consent doesn't just apply to intercourse. It applies to any kind of sexual, or it should apply to any kind of sexual activity. And it's difficult because when you think about it, somebody can change their mind, and you have to still be aware that they are giving their consent. They're still, because they said or appeared to give the impression that something was okay at one time, it doesn't mean that they're going to continue to give that consent. They can change their mind and withdraw it. So consent is something that you have to be looking for. You have to be on the lookout for it.
Exactly. And that's what Paul mentions there, is that in this sexual encounter, because he was okay in consenting to some things, his partner at the time thought, oh, he will be comfortable and consenting to other things. And
yes,
he wasn't.
And he wasn't.
I think hearing that from Paul shows, or at least showed me, the importance of a proper sex education. You know, he had to learn on the go, and that meant that his safety was...
compromised.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's so important. And detail is important. As he said, you know, there was a lot that he just was completely unaware of. And the whole consent issue is so important and so needs discussing. But also the nitty gritty, the nuts and bolts of what gay sex actually is would have been quite useful to know something about.
And that's the thing. So across the board, you had... not even maybe a basic understanding of what gay sex was, because that was denied by his sex education. You know, all it was is what we spoke about as well, which was the sort of heteronormative idea of it, anal sex, etc. So all these expectations that come with it. And then consent as well, which, as you say, we on this podcast, we will keep talking about it. It will
over
keep coming
up. Over and
over
again. It will keep coming up. Yeah,
and because,
absolutely.
Partly because it needs to, but partly because it is such a massive thing.
But also what he says about doing what you feel like doing will keep coming up, because that is so important. There are no... that you can't have rules about this sort of thing. I mean, and people do have really silly ideas, like all gay women don't like penetration. Some of them do. Some of them love it. And some absolutely hate it. But don't make assumptions about anybody, I think, is the answer.
You're absolutely right. But I think this also drums home the importance of learning about consent.
Absolutely.
And for your sex education, that needs to be a humongous pillar of it.
This starts in nursery. I mean, it starts so young when children ask for things, they learn to ask. They learn that sometimes people say no and that they have to manage their feelings when that happens. It starts so early and it should go all the way through school until it becomes more sophisticated as you reach your teens and as perhaps people are starting to think about becoming sexually active. But the general principle of consent can start from birth, really.
And hopefully it can continue through this podcast. And as I say, when we keep talking about it, we will keep drumming home those points. Because we've talked many a times about, oh, my sex education let me down because I didn't know how to put a condom on or whatever. This was where it wasn't just a cute teenage fumbling. This is
safety.
Exactly.
Yes.
After we spoke with Paul about consent, I asked him if there was anything else that made up his sex education.
There's one last part, and that is that in 1994, somebody rang my mum, don't know who, still don't know who, but it had to be one of my friends because they had my mum's number. It must have been a drunken prank from one of my friends. And just went, your son's gay. Put the phone down. And my mum rang me up and said, is this true? And I just burst into tears and I went around to chat to my mum. And I went into a bit of slough of depression as a result of having the whole coming out process to my mum taken away from me by a drunken friend. And I went to see one of those people that used to have in the 1990s that would advertise themselves, are you gay? Come and have a chat with us. We're non-judgmental people. And I rang the number and I went to a flat in Wimbledon. By a sort of benign 50, 60-year-old man. And what shocked me more than anything else is he literally had nothing useful to say to me whatsoever. His entire advice to me was, are you sure? Well, yeah, I've had sex with quite a lot of men by now. Okay, well, just in case you're not sure, join a swimming club.
I'm sorry.
What?
This is the advice he gave me. He said, if you have proximity to both young men and young women in the same environment, you'll soon find out whether you're gay or not. That was it.
Wow.
I was looking for some sort of, what on earth do I do with my life? And mum's just found out I'm gay. And I really don't know how to deal with it. And that was his advice? I couldn't believe it.
That's horrifying.
I haven't even discussed coming out to my dad in 2005. Now,
wow.
Coming out to my dad in 2005 is very much what my post-2005 years have all been about, because talking about it on stage in 2006 got me an Edinburgh Comedy nomination, which got me steps up in my career and this, that and the other.
Did it go well when you told him?
It went better than I could possibly have imagined. Number one, never underestimate the degree to which they've worked it out themselves.
Yeah.
But I also think what actually helped me was the number of my Bengali friends who'd had first marriages that failed.
Yeah.
They've all come from a background where you married someone and when you died, you widowed them. You know, that's all that ever happened. This idea that people could A, marry outside the community and B, marry the wrong person, and I think that's the key, helped me out.
For young people who are thinking about coming out to their parents, was there anything else that went well about you coming out to yours that maybe they can take solace in?
Never underestimate the degree to which your parents are people of the world. They may seem fuddy-duddy and otherworldly to you, and my God, he's never even heard of Tiny Temper. It may seem like that, but my mum and dad travelled through continents to make a new life. My mum was a midwife. To put it bluntly, she's seen a vagina or two. My dad was an anaesthetist, mostly in the obstetrics and gynaecology end of surgical procedures. They've lived a life, is what I'm saying. And so they may not understand necessarily what you're going through, but they do know at least that you didn't sit down one day and go, do you know what? I think I'm going to be gay. They're aware that this is who you are rather than who you chose to be.
So, Paul, we've spoken a lot about the 80s and sort of your younger formative years. I was just wondering, how do you think gay people are received now? You know, how have you been received coming out as a person, but also a person of public interest today? How have things changed?
I mean, I know in a nice little coda in February this year, I hosted a quiz for the old boys of my prep school. And when I say I hosted, I co-hosted it with my husband, Ollie, mm-hmm. who I described as my husband, Ollie. And nobody batted an eyelid. It was quite weird to square the circle again. It's a bit like the end of Billy Elliot when his gay friend turns up in the audience just to give a little wave and go, yes, that's all right. I became a happy gay man. You could relax.
Did that feel liberating then, to be back in that context and being so open?
Absolutely, yeah. It feels. I mean, who doesn't want to be open about their life? One of the things that we all crave is that we live our lives free of judgment and free of...
Shame.
Shame, yes. And just, this is my husband, Oliver. There has been coined on urbandictionary.com a phrase called the Sinha Sesh.
Right.
I'm well known for my enjoyment of hanging out with strangers, posing for selfies and getting drunk, and Ollie is always there.
Mm.
It's always, this is my husband, Ollie, or this is my boyfriend, Ollie, or this is my fiancé, Ollie. And people go, oh, yeah, hi, Ollie, how are you going? They don't go, oh, I didn't know you were gay. They go, oh, yeah, hi, Ollie. Mm. It's a joyous thing to see. Mm. The other day, I found a video of me and Ollie drunkenly singing to the song Impossible Dream at the end of our wedding. And it's a video that I watched quite a lot. And we were reduced to standing on chairs singing it. And the audience are cheering and screaming their delight. And I thought I'd put it on Twitter because I thought it was something entertaining to watch. The next thing I know, it's in the online pages of the tabloids. Cineman shares hilarious drunken video. And of the 42 comments in the Daily Mail comment section, all 42 were positive.
Mm.
Really?
It's not that I haven't had problems. I know what homophobia is. I know what racism is. It's just that having a life where I'm surrounded by relatively intelligent people all my life has inoculated me against the worst excesses of it, I think, is how I'd describe my life.
Yeah. So, Paul, now's the time in the show that we usually ask our guests, how was it for you? What did you learn, maybe about yourself or just in general?
How was it for me? Great. I love talking to strangers, and as you can tell, I never really stop talking. It's fine. And at this time, any human communication is great.
Yeah.
So how was it for me? Absolutely lovely. If I've learned one thing, all I really think is I never went into life actively wanting to be a person that was walking on his own on an outside lane. I don't know why life chose me as the person whose life is so weirdly not similar to anybody else's life, but I'm grateful for it in terms of a career in comedy.
I guess what's coming out very much for me listening to you is how much you value individuality, and I think that's a great takeaway, isn't it, that we should all just be ourselves.
Absolutely. If there's one thing that I'd like to be a patron saint of, if you like, it's that idea. As a gay person, you can be anything that you want to be. You don't have to be defined by what straight people and gay media have decided that you should be defined by. And the World Wide Web and the access to more information and the access to understanding alternative lifestyles and all of this helps. Mm. We live in a far, far bigger world than we did when I was a teenager in the 1980s, because the internet has opened up that world. If you want to go to a meeting for sadomasochistic, bisexual, transgender bridge players who have a thing for the ace of clubs rather than any of the other cards, you'll find one in West Norwood.
Yeah.
I mean, it'd be quite exciting, actually, to be 20 again and
go,
right, life's very different. I've looked on my Grindr and, my God, there are 15 different people who want to discuss last week's FA Cup semi-final on my Grindr. The whole world has changed. Grindr has changed everything, because Grindr will eventually lead to the death of the gay bar. Eventually.
Mm.
Because fundamentally, it recognises that most people went to a gay bar not to hear the music, but to try and meet new people. And now Grindr can bespoke the new people that you meet. One of the first times I went to a gay bar, they went bananas when they played I Heard a Rumour by Bananarama. Sorry, I didn't mean an unintentional pun. And I just thought, this is a relatively mediocre song by a likeable but fundamentally not groundbreaking all-female English vocal group. What's going on? My biggest act of defiance once was in a gay pub in Manchester, putting a song from Radiohead's OK Computer on just to see what would happen. And everyone just stared at me and wished I was dead. And I really, really enjoyed it. Going, it's better than Steps.
It's better than Steps.
Paul, thank you so, so, so much. It's been brilliant.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Thanks so much again.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you.
Take care. Bye-bye. And then close this. Get rid of this screen. These people are laughing at me. I just want these people to get the f*** out of my life.
It's the mailbag. Send Kate your queries to podcast@hatch.com. It's the mailbag. Send Kate your queries podcast@hatch2t's.
Hello there. I have a query for Kate. I would like to know when the real sex education mailbag starts.
The real sex education mailbag starts right now.
Thank you.
So, now is the time in the show where we take a look in our mailbox. It's your chance to have your questions answered by an accredited sex and relationships therapist. If you have any queries for Kate, you can send them in via email to podcasts@hatchet.com. That's Hatchet with two T's. And don't worry, we'll keep your anonymity unless you say otherwise, which is the case this week. We have this question from Anonymous, who says, I recently found out my partner had an affair, which was a devastating bombshell. I'm definitely not over it at all, but weirdly we're having a lot of really good sex. This seems right at the time, but should we be doing this?
No, this happens to a lot of couples. It's a kind of way of rebonding after what's happened. Quite often people do that for a while and then they come to a point where they don't want to do it anymore, or often the other partner who hasn't had the affair decides they want to stop being so close. But it is quite a common phase that people go through after an affair.
That's really interesting. So we have another one here, another anonymous. My girlfriend loves having her nipples licked and sucked. I sometimes reading these out to you. I'll try and start again. My girlfriend loves having her nipples licked and sucked, but they're really hairy and this puts me off. I find I'm avoiding lovemaking. Should I just put up with it or should I tell her?
Oh, that sounds quite sad. Obviously, it would be better to be honest. You could do more touch than oral touching, but it's better to be honest and just explain, because obviously she might not be aware, but it needs some sensitivity. So maybe while you're licking, you could say, oh, little hair here, you know, like that. Or maybe not. I mean, it really does depend on being incredibly sensitive, I think. But it is a conversation that needs to be had.
Yeah, especially if they like it, you know.
Yeah, these things are so difficult. But I always say secrets are so much worse than being honest. And you have a difficult conversation and then it's over with.
Secrets are so much worse. I want that on a T-shirt. That's brilliant.
That would be a good T-shirt.
Well, thank you for all your submissions to Kate. Again, if you'd like to put a query to Kate about anything sex or relationship related, or would just like to get in touch, we're podcasts@hatchet.com. That's Hatchet with two T's. A big thank you to Paul Sinha and Kate Campbell. Cheers, Mum.
Cheers, Diggs.
And see you next week for more real sex education. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Real Sex Education, which is hosted by Diggory Waite and Kate Campbell. The show is produced by Andy Goddard and Diggory Waite. The Real Sex Education is a Hattrick podcast. If you'd like to hear more podcasts by Hattrick, including Time Ghost with Alexander Armstrong and Ben Miller, just search Hattrick Podcasts on your podcast provider of choice. This podcast is based on the real-life relationship between the host, Diggory Waite, and his mother, accredited sex therapist Kate Campbell. The show is therefore inspired by, but otherwise unrelated to, the TV show Sex Education. But yes, Diggory does wish his co-host was Gillian Anderson.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.